Thank you, Brian. And thanks to Dr. Perry and the organizing committee for the opportunity to be here and speak with you today. Kind of as an overview of where we're going to go today, there are many factors important to fertilization. There's no possible way I can even scratch the surface in 30-minute time frame. I've tried to provide more in-depth information in the manuscript, so when you have a chance, you can look at that. What we're going to do today is we're going to start out with a discussion of semen quality and number of sperm. We're going to move on to a discussion of accessory sperm and their importance, what we believe the importance of accessory sperm are. We'll look at individual bull effect and the time of AI. We'll also touch a little bit on semen handling, and then also a little bit about fertility-associated antigen on some recent data that I have there. I've got to mention at this first point, I feel kind of like a fish out of water here because I think I'm probably the only one in the room who focuses on dairy. And when Dr. Smith showed the graph of the descending pregnancy rates, and that's also in the manuscript, when he got to the bottom, I thought, you know, if that's dairy, we give awards for that. So it's all where your starting point is. It's all what your perspective is, okay? And certainly we've made great strides in dairy in recent years with many different protocols, whether it's pre-sync, off-sync, re-sync, double off-sync, et cetera. And we're very proud of that. But I implore you to learn more about ester synchronization and take full advantage of the information here, because you have a unique opportunity to continue to grow and really grow fast. I mean, these numbers, the research data that I've seen over the years at these meetings is fantastic, fantastic. Okay, so we're going to go ahead with a quick discussion on semen quality. We're going to break it up into compensable seminal traits and uncompensable seminal traits. Compensable seminal traits are essentially viability or morphology traits that we believe impair sperm transport and egg penetration or ovum penetration. Fertilization generally does not occur. Okay? How might this be the situation? It's generally in severely misshapen sperm in an otherwise normal semen sample. So, reduced fertility may be overcome or minimized by increasing sperm numbers in the dose that is inseminated to the female. Okay, so that's compensable. We can compensate. The other half of the equation, or the other side of the coin, is uncompensable seminal traits, and this relates to incompetence of the fertilizing sperm. Completion of fertilization and maintenance of the embryo does not occur. And the scary thing here is that there's evidence, that damaged DNA in otherwise normally shaped sperm are uncompensable factors. As you would expect, given the terminology, uncompensable, reduced fertility would be expected regardless of sperm dosage. So if we kind of put it all together and we look at a variety of different bulls, here we have four different bulls, A, B, C, and D. We have on the vertical axis fertility going up. We have increasing numbers of sperm on the x-axis right here. And we have some threshold of the population shown here. And we can see bull A and bull B as numbers of sperm, and these are viable sperm, are increasing. They reach the maximal level of fertility within that population, at which point then it becomes a female question or a micro-managing type question. However, if we look at bulls C and D, bulls C and D have a large proportion of uncompensable traits in their semen, and no matter how many sperm we put in the dose, they will never reach this threshold of the population, and they will remain at a subfertile or unacceptable fertility level. Okay. Whether we're looking at natural service or we're looking at artificial insemination, we're looking at a bull that serves one cow. We're talking billions of sperm inseminated, billions in the anterior vagina. Okay? On the other hand, if we're looking at artificial insemination, we're looking at millions of sperm. And yet we all know it only takes one to actually fertilize the egg. So a reasonable question shown in this cartoon is the bull's asking, what did you do with all those sperm? And we could ask the same question when we deposit 25 million past the cervix into the uterine body. And years ago, when working with Dr. Sacchi, Dr. Sacchi had come up with a bioassay of using accessory sperm as a way to try and figure out what's going on with sperm transport, what's going on with all the sperm that are inseminated, how might we be able to increase fertility in this way. And what this means is accessory sperm are not sperm that actually fertilize, but they are sperm that are competing for fertilization. So there's a group of sperm that are competing for fertilization, and the accessory ones we were looking at are actually the losers, if you want, and they are stuck in the outermost covering of the egg, which is known as the zona pellucida. And they get stuck in there by the block to polyspermy, which the zona reaction, which is initiated by the fertilizing sperm shown here. And what we can do then is we can recover embryos from cows on day 6 or day 7, and we can actually prepare the embryo and visualize accessory sperm. So what is the significance? Why do we go to all the trouble of setting up cows, inseminating cows, and then 6 days later flushing the embryos out and squashing them and counting sperm? And the reason we did that is because we know increased accessory sperm number is associated with increased fertilization rate and embryo quality. So from a research standpoint, if we can increase accessory sperm number by applying some sort of treatments, research has shown we can increase fertilization rate and embryo quality, which translationally in the real world is a good thing. Okay? And this is just a picture showing the smear of the zona pellucida, and these are actually the sperm here, and we would do literally a count. Okay. We've done a variety of different research trying to increase accessory sperm. Again, there's not the time to talk about that. I have a table in the manuscript which describes that. We're going to look at two different treatments that we had. One was specific bull. One was the time of AI, and these both had a positive effect increasing accessory sperm. So the question is there a bull effect on accessory sperm number, on the ability to get sperm to the egg and compete for fertilization? And the answer is yes, there is. We can see we have four different bulls shown here, and these are not the same bulls that were shown previously on the previous graph. They just share the nomenclature A, B, C, and D. And then we have median number, which is the 50th percentile number, as you go from lowest value of accessory sperm to highest. And then we have the mean plus standard deviation. And you can see here the mean plus standard deviation. There's a lot of noise in the system, a lot of variability. And being that it's a skewed distribution, the median becomes more valuable from a statistical standpoint. The take-home message: is there a bull effect on accessory sperm number? Yes, there is. This bull here has a median number of 40 accessory sperm. This bull has a median of 8. This bull has a median of 13. If we just look at those top three, we would expect that the top bull is the most resistant to possible errors in insemination technique or in timing. Okay. These other bulls would be a little bit less resistant to those errors. This bull here would likely have fertility maximized when there are minimal to no errors. There's very little room for movement, very little evidence that there are numerous sperm able to survive and be present at the time of fertilization. Okay. Looking at seminal quality and accessory sperm, research by Mel DeJarnett at Luxeyers, looking into the effect of average versus below average semen on fertilization status and embryo quality. This is, again, accessory sperm data. We have the percentage of embryos shown here, and we have a fertilization status and embryo quality shown on the bottom. These are day six embryos. They're classified as excellent to good, fair to poor, degenerate, or UFOs. You can see there is an effect of seminal quality. Average semen that has been deemed in an AI stud to be of average seminal quality, we're looking at morphology here, showed a higher percentage of excellence in goods, fair poors, and lower percentage of degenerates in UFOs. The other side of the equation, the other way to look at this, is, well, how did below average seminal quality do? Below average semen had an increased percentage of UFOs and degenerates, unfertilized eggs and degenerates, and had less excellent goods, excellent to goods, and fair to poors. Okay. I touched on this just a little bit about the uncompensable trait when we first mentioned that, and I want to come back and talk just for a second on the relationship between sperm morphology and chromatin structure. We're talking about DNA here. Okay? We know that normal-shaped sperm, as we would visualize them, normal-shaped sperm in abnormal ejaculates exhibit vulnerability to DNA denaturation. Okay? We can cause DNA denaturation very easily in laboratory. The scary thing is denatured DNA doesn't always appear in abnormal-shaped sperm. And what this slide is showing here is we have two sperm cells here that have essentially are normal, and they are showing DNA denaturation by virtue that they have turned red after being stained. Okay, these are sperm that were collected 27 days after a scrotal insulation. So we wanted to induce problems in bulls, and we did induce problems in bulls. But the problem that we see from this is, the question is, with routine laboratory morphology procedures, is morphology just the tip of the iceberg? Getting to the point, if we see what appears to be a normal morphological sperm head, does that mean that the DNA below it are affected or not affected? Okay. And as we all know, the iceberg obviously has a whole big story going on under the water. In general, uncompensable traits tend to describe or appear as a result of some sort of spermatogenic distress in general. Okay, so that's the effect of the bull. Let's go on and talk a little bit. How does time of AI affect fertilization rate, embryo quality, and accessory sperm? So we want to talk a little bit about the actual timing of AI. We had, in this study, we had three different treatments for time of AI. We have a 0 hour, a 12 hour, and a 24 hour. And we also used HeatWatch, similar to Dr. Patterson's discussion this morning. And we literally checked the computer around the clock every 3 hours. And we had animals that came into heat all around the clock, of course. If an animal came into heat at 3:03 a.m. and was a 0 hour treatment, we would breed her right then. If an animal came into heat at 3:03 a.m. and she was a 24 hour, we'd come back in 24 hours and breed her, or in 12 hours, depending upon her treatment. We were very close, within 2 hours, to this one, and we were almost exact for 12 hour and 24 hour treatments. Okay? So again, using HeatWatch. We then, 6 days later, recovered the embryos and looked at fertilization status and embryo quality. And what you can see here, as we went from the zero-hour treatment to the 12-hour treatment to the 24-hour treatment, median accessory sperm actually increased. So that's a good thing. It's a good thing. More sperm competing. There's more sperm present at the site of fertilization. We want to see that. And then the association with increased fertilization status and embryo quality. And we also see an increase in fertilization rate. So if we were just to look at this data, we would say, well, gee, 24 hours looks pretty good because we have a fertilization rate that's numerically the highest, and we have median accessory sperm numbers, which are high. That's only part of the story, because we need to look at embryo quality. And you can see here, fertilization rate is the lowest, and that was shown previously, and it was the highest in the 24-hour treatment in this bar shown here. So that's not surprising. But interestingly enough, the highest percentage of excellent and good embryos did not occur at the 24-hour treatment. It occurred at the zero-hour treatment. That's the highest percentage of excellent and good embryos occurred here. The highest percentage of fair and poors occurred at the 12-hour. And the highest percentage of degenerate embryos occurred here at the 24-hour treatment. And this should be dovetailing with what Dr. Smith brought up earlier very well about time of insemination and his graph showing fertile life of sperm, the need for time for capacitation, and life of the egg. That all should be going on in your head right now, and you should have come up with this without me even talking about it. But I'll go ahead and talk about it anyway, because this is our discussion, kind of summarizing that data that I just described. So we have conception rate here shown on this graph, on this axis here. We have the three different treatments, 0, 12, and 24 hours from the heat watch study. In general, breeding at 0 hours, we saw very low fertilization rate. It was the lowest fertilization rate, but we saw very high embryo quality. High embryo quality. Okay? If we go to the other end of the spectrum, 24-hour treatment, we had very high fertilization rate. It was very high, but we had overall a low embryo quality. That doesn't sound too good. And really what we have to look at is perhaps when breeding early, there is an inadequate sperm life because we have to wait from the initiation of that first mount approximately 28 hours in dairy cattle up to 30, 31 hours in beef cattle for ovulation to occur. That could have stressed out, certainly, population of the sperm cells in that ejaculate, and the ones that did survive were the best and provided, therefore, good embryo quality or high embryo quality. On the other hand, if we go to the other extreme, and Dr. Smith mentioned this morning, when we're inseminating very close to ovulation, here we're inseminating within about 4 hours of ovulation. Not only are we worried about capacitation and the ability of sperm to be able to fertilize, we also have to look at the picture a little bit bigger than that and think about sperm transport. Because sperm transport is actually larger in time than the capacitation time factor. So, insemination at 24 hours, we theorize there's less sperm selection in general, and we have ovulation occurring, and the clock is ticking. That egg is waiting. It's ready to be fertilized, but there isn't a population of sperm at the site or able to fertilize yet. So we kind of have this compromise right here in the center. Again, in the middle, probably for dairy, 6 to 16 hours. It in much of the work that Dr. Patterson and Dr. Smith showed a 12-hour peak to insemination. So we're right in there. Want to just touch on sperm transport for a second there. And sperm transport, again, is going to be intermingled, of course, with the ability of sperm to fertilize, capacitation, the requirement for capacitation. We have to remember there's a rapid phase and a sustained phase for sperm transport. The rapid phase takes minutes, and it's not the first one that gets there that wins. Actually, they're the losers. There's not enough time for them to be able to be capacitated. Therefore, they're not unable to fertilize. And research has shown in the oviduct that the majority of these sperm that are transported in the rapid phase are actually dead. The sustained phase, depending upon the literature, about 6 to 12 hours in cattle. Okay? 12 is probably pretty long, maybe 6 to 10 hours. Okay? But we do know in the oviduct, over this time period, there is an increased percentage of motile sperm that are present and an increased percentage of morphologically normal sperm. The female does a very good job in many instances of trying to weed out sperm. So, now we have to go back a step. When should AI occur? Well, AI should occur at a time where we consider all of these factors. We have our first standing event shown here, 0 hour. And then some general recommendations. If we AI between 4 to 16 hours, if we were to know the beginning of an estrus event, then you would have to add your sperm transport on. Again, if you have a 16-hour insemination at 16 hours and sperm transport takes 8 hours, then you have 16 plus 8 is 24, and the sperm will be there, will be ready for an ovulation that occurs at approximately 28 hours. So you can do the math, and you can go back and forth, very similar to what Dr. Smith showed earlier. The same thing can be said for the development of protocols, and where should AI occur, timed AI? Should it occur at 66 hours? Should it occur at 72? Should it occur at 60? Same type of thing. You need to characterize estrus and ovulation. And in this example, we're just showing a little bit tighter ovulation range here, if you will. And this was some work, I believe. Yeah, this is some work that was done in Bos Indicus and shows a little bit different recommended time for AI relative to sperm transport to have a population of sperm here. Okay? Okay. Now comes the audience participation part, because I've probably put most of you to sleep because I'm droning on about sperm. Okay. I'm going to give, there's one, two, three, there's four sections here. And I certainly don't want to steal any Dr. Stroud's thunder from later today, but I do want a representative from every section here to give me an answer. And one of the things that we have when we synchronize cows, or when we have very large herds, and even if we don't synchronize them, we got a whole bunch of cows to breed at one time in one day. And I teach a lot of AI schools, And everyone's always looking for the shortcut. Always looking for the shortcut because I got to get back on the tractor. I got to do something else. And I recognize that. But you also have to do things properly so you actually end up with pregnant cows and heifers. Okay? So, we're going to start in the far group over here. How many straws should be thawed at one time? The far group over there, If someone doesn't suggest a number of straws, I'm going to have to draft. So, how many straws should be thawed at one time? 2, 4, 6, 10, 12, 42? 5, they say. Okay, what about this group? You can agree or say, no, they're nuts. 6, 5 and 6? 10? 2. Dr. Seidel's being very, very conservative today. Okay. Great. I love that answer. And I love that answer because we have data on this. We have data on this, okay? If we look at the effect of sequential insemination, sequential insemination is cow number 1, cow number 2, cow number 3 in a sequence who received their insemination following batch thawing of semen, which is what we're talking about, thawing 4 or 6 or 8 straws together. And if we look just at the first 4 inseminations, because that's the most robust data. This is dairy. I will apologize for the low numbers. This is dairy. There is no difference in fertility. From the first insemination in the first cow to the fourth insemination of the fourth cow. Now, people furiously writing it down. Don't try this at home because I haven't told you the whole story yet. Okay? I have not told you the whole story yet. This is where we need to start. Okay? So, we still have the question, how many straws should be thawed at one time? The recommendation is no more than can be used in 10 to 15 minutes. There is a time limitation. You got to remember with semen handling time, temperature, hygiene, and skill. Okay, for anyone who breeds cows, it should come off your tongue that simply. Time, temperature, hygiene, and skill. No more should be thawed than can be used in 10 to 15 minutes. That means from the time that first straw hits the thaw bath until you are removing your arm and the gun from that last cow, no more than 10 to 15 minutes have elapsed. That includes, obviously, loading the gun, walking to the cow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or cows, heifers, whatever the case may be. Okay, know your comfort zone. I will be the first to admit I would have a hard time with 6 or 8 straws. It's just not going to happen. I do not have the manual dexterity. I also recognize if it's not all the same bowl, I know exactly how long it's going to take me to pull it out of canister 1, cane 1, canister 6, cane 2. I know how long that's going to take. I know how long it takes me to load the guns and walk to the cows and heifers. Okay? So, know your comfort zone. If you're loading in an office, because you've got all the equipment in the office and then you have a 5-minute walk or you're getting in the truck, you have to include that in the time category. Okay? And this does still play a role even if you use battery pack gun warmers. There's no increase in time allowed. Okay? Do not allow straws to touch when thawing. We know that there will be further damage to sperm cells if we allow straws to actually touch and then come apart and continue thawing. If this is a technique that you can perform, again, within the 10 to 15 minutes, use multiple thaw baths. What happens if you load 6 straws into a thaw bath? Does the temperature magically stay 95 to 98 degrees? Somebody scream, no! It doesn't. It doesn't. And then the other part, which I won't talk about, is don't leave straws in the thaw bath and come back to them because they are at lower temperature than you already started them at because your thaw bath is going to be struggling to get back to temperature if it's an electric thaw bath. If you don't have an electric thaw bath, it won't come back. Time, temperature, hygiene, and skill. Okay? Okay, inseminator skill. This is the visual. Thank you, Select Sires. This is it. It doesn't get better than this. Okay, this is the side of semen deposition, the uterine body. Okay, not the cervix. So how does deposition of semen into the cervix affect fertility? We know from some very elegant research done by McPherson in the 60s that there is at least a 10% decrease in fertility when semen is deposited in the cervix as compared to deposition in the uterine body. The whole idea with AI is to go past the cervix. That's the whole idea. The barrier to sperm transport is the cervix. Okay? We also know cervical deposition of semen occurs in about 20% of attempted uterine body depositions. Some of the work out of Phil Sanger's lab when he was at Penn State. Okay, I'm going to wrap things up on some more recent work that I've done looking at fertility-associated antigen. And the question that we asked was, does fertility-associated antigen on sperm collected from Nellore Vos indicus bulls affect fertility at first service timed AI? This was not done in Idaho, obviously. This is done in Brazil, where the Nellore is very prominent and economically and culturally important. So just to bring you back up to date on fertility-associated antigen, this is dates back to Dr. Roy Axe's work at Wisconsin and Arizona. We know that during ejaculation that the seminal vesicles, prostate, and Cowper's glands secrete heparin-binding proteins, and these coat the sperm. And there's also data that bulls with sperm that exhibited a certain size heparin-binding protein, 31 kilodaltons, and it was called fertility-associated antigen, they were actually 7 to 9 percentage points more fertile following AI than bulls producing sperm lacking FAA. Okay, sounds like a good thing. 7 to 9 percentage points higher. That's kind of where we were going with this research. We collected semen from 49 Nellore bulls, and immediately following semen collection, we followed the directions on the package, took 2 mL of semen, transferred to a lateral flow cassette. It's like a home pregnancy test. Okay? And that facilitated rapid on-site determination of fertility-associated antigen. You can see that here. We are looking for a band in the test line here. You can see it shown here. This is a control, which should always be there. This is the positive, and this would be negative and negative. So presence of FAA in the sample results in a visible colored band at the test position. Okay, so then what do we do? After we looked at the 49 bulls, we took 3 that were FAA negative, 3 that were FAA positive. We collected semen. We made sure that the seminal characteristics were equal to or greater than 70% morphologically normal. Okay? And they had 60% estimated progressive motility before freezing. They were extended, according to the AI studs, normal procedures in quarter mil straws at a reasonable dose of 30 million cells, which was standard for these bulls at this AI center. Okay, here are the results. Fertility-associated antigen status is shown here for the 3 FAA-positive bulls, for the 3 FAA-negative bulls. This is pregnancy per timed AI. All animals, 400 animals here, 435 animals here, were done at the same time. Okay, same farm. FAA-positive animals, 41.5%. FAA negative, 39.3%, was not statistically significant. It was not significant in this project. That's for cows. So then we went ahead and looked at it in heifers, again using a standard estrosynchronization protocol. And again, the graph is set up exactly the same way. Pregnancy per timed AI shown here, FAA positive and FAA negative. Fertility-associated antigen status here. 300 animals that were bred to FAA-positive bulls had a pregnancy per timed AI of almost 34%. But holy cow, look what happened. FAA-negative bulls actually outperformed the FAA-positive bulls. Okay? So, that right there, we're going to talk a little bit more about. We actually had a flip-flop in what we thought. So to conclude, there was no effect of FAA status on fertility at first service timed AI in lactating cows. That's the lactating cows. Fertility, though, was different between FAA-positive and FAA-negative bulls. And FAA-positive bulls were actually lower than negative bulls, which is contrary to what we would expect and contrary to the previous body of data, unless you look at individual bulls in the previous data, and then it all makes sense. Okay, we're rounding the corner here. Take-home messages, compensable seminal traits relate to the ability of the inseminated sperm to initiate fertilization. We believe they do not participate. These sperm do not. Severely misshapen sperm, okay, usually. Consequently, reduced fertility may be overcome or minimized by increasing sperm numbers. Uncompensable traits are the other side of the coin. Competence of the fertilizing sperm to complete fertilization and sustain early embryonic development generally does not occur, and therefore we have reduced fertility regardless of sperm dosage. You cannot fix that. So to reduce the risk of uncompensable seminal traits, number one recommendation, use semen from AI studs where morphology is a routine part of the evaluation. Okay, that's number one. Number two, use multiple proven high fertility bulls. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Screen all natural service bulls with a complete breeding soundness evaluation, which includes sperm morphology. Okay? Time of AI. Close enough to ovulation. That's what we should focus on to maximize sperm access to the ovum, but not too late to have the egg waiting. Okay? Proper semen handling is critical. Time, temperature, hygiene, and skill. And relative to fertility-associated antigen. And this also relates to most things where we try and look at just one aspect, is that presence of FAA on spermatozoal membranes does not guarantee higher fertility. I have to acknowledge a whole bunch of people that worked with me on these projects and that did these projects even before my time. See them right here, all this personnel, the personnel in Brazil, personnel at Virginia Tech when I was there, Select Sires, NAB, Virginia Ag Council, Alta Genetics Brazil, and Animal Health Express in Arizona. Dr. Sacchi right here, I am indebted to for a variety of things. This is Dr. Sharon Adair, who flushed a lot of cows with me. A lot of the data you see there, our technician, Judy Baim, here. Veterinarian here, who helped flush a whole bunch of cows with us. And got to show the family. Thank you very much.